the headlines, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and the Armenian Prime Minister Pashinyan highlight the need for sustainable peace and security in the Caucasus region. Russia conducts one of the heaviest missile strikes against Ukraine since the start of the war after Moscow's Black Sea Fleet were targeted in a massive drone attack. And police in South Korea admit that their crowd control tactics on the night of Halloween were not enough. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. President Ebrahim Raisi reiterates Iran's stance that the dispute between Armenia and Azerbaijan in the Caucasus should be resolved by regional players. Raisi was speaking in a joint press conference with the visiting Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan after the two officials held talks on expanding bilateral ties. The Iranian president added that any foreign interference in the Caucasus will only add to the regional problems. Raisi also said peace and security in the Caucasus region are of prime significance for Iran. He also talked about bilateral relations with Armenia. Raisi said achieving the target trade of $3 billion with Armenia is possible if Tehran and Yerevan both show determination in that regard. Pashinyan also echoed Raisi on the need for sustainable peace and security in the Caucasus. Iran has imposed sanctions on a number of American individuals and entities for offenses including human rights violations and supporting terrorism. Iran's foreign ministry says they were also sanctioned for interfering in Iran's internal affairs, instigating violence and riots in the country, and committing economic terrorism against the Iranian nation. 10 individuals and 4 entities are on the blacklist. They include the commander of the U.S. Central Command, the U.S. Deputy Secretary of Treasury, the CIA, and the U.S. National Guard. Over the past few weeks, the U.S. and its allies have imposed several rounds of sanctions on Iran over what they call a crackdown on anti-government protests. Iran dismisses the allegations, saying it is dealing with foreign-backed riots. Iran says an informal meeting the U.S. plans to hold in the U.N. Security Council on the recent riots in the country sets a dangerous precedent. Iran's ambassador to the U.N. says the U.S. is not qualified legally, morally, and politically to hold such a meeting. The informal meeting is jointly proposed by the U.S. and Albania. The envoy says that the meeting would be a hypocritical and deceitful attempt to abuse human rights against Iran. Amir Said Erevani says that the U.S. seeks to exploit human rights to advance its own political objectives. Iran has been witnessing riots since last month over the death of 22-year-old woman Mahsa Amini. Moving on, Russia's President Vladimir Putin has held a trilateral summit with the leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan in the wake of tensions between the two ex-Soviet neighbors. In a joint statement after the talks, Baku and Yerevan agreed not to use force to resolve their dispute over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Our correspondent, Marina Kursunova, has the details.
Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted the leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan in an attempt to help the two ex-Soviet states settle their long-standing conflict. Putin said he's hopeful that the summit will make it possible to outline steps to resolve the Nagorno-Karabakh issue, adding the Armenian leadership has the political will to resolve the conflict with Azerbaijan. Putin, however, noted Moscow does not impose anything on anyone and only offers a peaceful solution.
I know that you have the political will for this, and we support it in every possible way. We must find the key points that will allow us to move forward. This conflict has been going on for decades, so we still need to end it sometime.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan reacted to Putin's remarks, voicing his readiness to accept Moscow's offer to establish diplomatic relations with Baku. Azerbaijan President Ilham Aliyev also said that the Karabakh conflict has already become history and it is time to talk about the normalization of relations between Yerevan and Baku. He expressed gratitude to Russia for trying to resolve the issue. Some experts believe the US and some European countries, particularly France, are trying to foment discord between Armenia from Russia, reform their friendly relations to hostility, withdraw Armenia from the CSTO and encourage Yerevan for a new large-scale military conflict with Azerbaijan.
France is actively intervening in the conflict. NATO's interests are visible behind it. The USA has one of its largest embassies in Yerevan, the same with Azerbaijan. There goes Israel and the UK. The latter is one of Turkey's closest friends. Another bloc of countries is being formed there, but they all work in the same direction. They are opposed to the participation of Iran and Russia in resolving this conflict and are trying to replace the participation of neighboring states with that of Western ones. This deprives the people of Armenia and Azerbaijan of a peaceful solution.
A six-week war between Azerbaijan and Armenia in 2020, which claimed the lives of more than 6,500 troops on both sides, ended with a Russian brokered deal that saw Yerevan cede swathes of territory that it had controlled for several decades. Last month, 286 people from both sides were killed in the flare-up of new clashes.
Moscow's task is to find ground for a compromise. The interference of Turkey, France, Britain and the United States in the Armenian-Azerbaijani relations in recent months, the so-called Western Peace Project may simply threaten the disappearance of Nagorno-Karabakh. Most experts believe the mediation of such countries is a trap from which there is no way out. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The Ukrainian army says Russia has hit the country with a volley of 55 cruise missiles as well as other ammunition. The army says the Monday attack hit civilian targets. Ukraine's presidential adviser has described the strike as one of the largest since the war began in February. Officials say that the strikes left hundreds of areas across Ukraine without power. Russia's President Vladimir Putin says the attack was a partial response to drone strikes on the country's Black Sea Fleet. Putin says Russia could have done more. Putin has blamed Ukraine for the attacks that prompted Moscow to suspend a deal to allow Ukrainian grain exports despite the war. Our correspondent Johnny Miller is on the ground in Crimea. He earlier joined us with more details about the situation there.
Last night I spoke to a contact of mine who is from Kiev. She told me that the situation for Kiev residents is becoming more and more difficult. The mayor, Vitaly Klitschko, of course, says that 80% of people in Kiev no longer have running water due to these Russian strikes. So in the future, we may well start to see more refugees leaving Ukraine, fleeing to Europe. That may well put more policy on European government, more pressure on European governments. So this war not only being fought on the battlefield, but also to influence public opinion and to pressure European governments to change their policy on Ukraine.
South Korea promises a speedy inquiry into the recent Halloween crush in the capital, Seoul, in an attempt to calm public anger over the deadly incident. In a parliamentary address, the Interior Minister Lee Sang-min has apologized to the public and pledged to make sure such disasters do not happen again. He has faced fierce criticism for stating that deployment of more police would not have prevented the tragedy. The police chief has also acknowledged police missteps that contributed to the incident.
We found out that there were lots of 112 calls before the accident about the seriousness of the place. The calls were about the emergencies telling the danger and urgency of the situation that large crowds had gathered before the accident occurred. However, we think the police response to the 112 calls was inadequate.
Have also said that they had no guidelines to handle the expectedly large crowd. South Korea is observing a seven-day mourning period over the tragedy. The stampede took place as South Koreans marked their first mask-free Halloween in 3 years. People were crushed after those at the top of a sloped alley fell over the others. The incident has so far killed 156 people. The dead are from South Korea and 14 other countries. Scores of others are also injured, 30 in critical condition. Meanwhile, North Korea has called on the United States and South Korea to stop their joint large-scale military drills. It is warning that the war games are a provocation that may draw more powerful follow-up measures. The foreign ministry said the situation on the Korean Peninsula has entered a serious confrontation phase due to, quote, reckless U.S.-South Korea military moves. The ministry warned that Washington and Seoul have to take the blame for all the consequences if they do not stop their military exercises all at once. The U.S. and South Korea began one of their largest joint military air drills on Monday. The operation will run until Friday and will feature about 240 warplanes. Washington and Seoul say Pyongyang may be about to resume testing of nuclear bombs for the first time since 2017, and that is why they are holding the drills. Pyongyang, however, views the drills as a rehearsal for an invasion. China slams the U.S. decision to deploy nuclear-capable bombers to Australia, warning such moves undermine regional peace and stability. The spokesman said that defense and security cooperation between countries should not target third parties. Washington reportedly plans to deploy six B-52 bombers to an airbase in northern Australia. The report cited the Air Force as saying that the move is a show of Washington's ability to project air lethal power against its adversaries. Meanwhile, the development is expected to further fuel tensions between Beijing and Canberra. China considers all plans by the U.S. to expand its military power in the Pacific as provocative and part of attempts to contain China's military. The death toll from the collapse of a pedestrian suspension bridge in western India has risen to 137. The Indian Prime Minister expresses sadness over the tragedy in his home state and says rescue operations are ongoing.
I express my condolences to the families of the people who have lost their lives in this accident. In this hour of grief, the government is with the bereaved families in every manner. The Gujarat government has been carrying out the rescue operations with all its might since last evening.
Most of those who died were women and children or the elderly. The death toll is expected to rise as rescuers are combing through the river to find the missing ones. More than 177 people have been rescued so far. Police say 9 people associated with the company that maintained the bridge have been arrested. Hundreds of people were on the bridge when it collapsed on Sunday. The bridge was overcrowded as people had come there to celebrate Diwali or the Festival of Light. The structure had only reopened to the public last week after undergoing renovation. It was originally built during the British rule in the 19th century. Our correspondent in New Delhi, Munawar Zaman, says building and other structural collapses are common in India.
A very tragic incident. Still, they are conducting the cleanup operations, and they have rescued some 180 people, and the rescue operation is still going on, and the NDRF team, the disaster management team, they're all coordinating with each other, trying to find out if more bodies will be recovered. And of course, it is expected that more people are still missing, and the death toll could probably mount. And this tragedy has happened just before the state goes for polls in next year in February. So there's a lot of political battle going on in the country, everybody blaming each other. But yes, we can imagine the bridge was given a contract for just mere 20 million Indian rupees, which is just something to worry about. That's such a huge bridge that is a tourist attraction, given such a small amount of money, but at the same time, the contractor subcontracting the same contract to other company. Well, this is something major problem in India, and this happens. India has a phenomenal record about these building collapses. Even when we speak yesterday, there was a building collapse in Mumbai where 4 or 5 people died and some were critically injured. So construction has always been an issue in the country of more than a billion people. And there is no drastic step or critical measures that could be taken to prevent it.
Israel has approved the construction of 135 new settler units in a highly controversial area east of Al-Quds. The new construction will take place in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The regime has led a heavy crackdown on local Palestinian families protesting their expulsion from their homes. A flare-up in tensions in the neighborhood triggered deadly clashes in Al-Quds in 2021. The violence also sparked the tensions that led to the May 2021 war between Israeli regime and resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. The UN Security Council has time and again condemned Israel's settlement construction and has called for an end to the expansionist policy. All Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories are considered illegal under international law. Meanwhile, polls open in the fifth parliamentary elections in Israel in less than 4 years, with former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu pushing to stage a comeback. Opinion polls show Netanyahu's right-wing Likud party is one seat short of a parliamentary majority. The centrist added party of caretaker Prime Minister Yair Lapid also projected to finish second in the race. The election results will be announced on Wednesday. The polls come after a coalition of eight anti-Netanyahu parties led by Lapid's ally Naftali Bennett collapsed in June. The coalition disbanded over defections as the government struggled to address security and inflation. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. Those who remember Allah. This is the mark of someone who has an intellect. They remember Allah, standing, sitting, and laying on their sides. The Quran, Surah 3, verse 191. In other words, in every circumstance, they remember. However, remembering Allah here does not refer to the mystical trance-like state of the dervish that some people crave. Always remembering Allah, always chanting, Hu. But that is not what we mean. We mean actively remembering God. But what is it to actively remember God, such that His remembrance is counted as an act? How can one achieve this? And reflect on the creation of the heavens and the earth. Do you see? Those who have intellects, those who are truly wise, are those who ponder and think, and reflect on the creation of the heavens and the earth. And as they ponder on this, they say, whether inwardly in their hearts or outwardly with their tongues, Our Lord, You have not created this in vain. Immaculate are You. You have not created this without a purpose. You are too immaculate to have made this without a purpose. In other words, this is the most fundamental principle of their belief system or worldview.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Each and every worldview starts from a simple fact. We are here for some purpose. If you believe in God, you say you were created for a purpose. And if you do not believe in God, you say you have a purpose here. Do you see the most fundamental idea of a philosophy that is meant to inspire a way of life, whether for an individual or a society, is this: Our Lord, you have not created this in vain. He is a theist. He believes in God. So he says, Our Lord, you did not create heavens and the earth and all they contain for no reason. You are too immaculate and wise to do such a thing. Therefore, I have a moral responsibility. I must follow a path. I am but a speck among the wonders of the cosmos. But I am here for a reason. In this grand edifice, you have made a place for me and given me a purpose to fulfill. But I might disrupt the harmony of this system. Immaculate are you. So save us from the punishment of the fire. Whilst the fire of the resurrection is real, it is also a symbol of the fire of God's wrath, anger and retribution, and of the cosmos. You must pay attention to this because this is all a prelude so that we can apprehend the meaning of faith based on understanding from these verses.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A special meeting has been held by the UN, titled UN Security Council Counterterrorism. The focus was on technology and the rapid rise in digitization, the use of new and emerging technologies to counter terrorism. In the meeting, the UN cited the important roles that victims and their networks can play in countering terrorism, and to pay tribute to India and how it was a terrorism victim back in 2008.
Excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, let me extend a warm welcome to all of you in Mumbai, the financial capital of India, for attending this soft opening of the special meeting of the Counter-Terrorism Committee of the Security Council, as well as the informal briefing on countering the financing of terrorism in national and regional context.
Yet there was one country that was not mentioned, one which has been a victim of terrorism, one which was a victim of a terrorist attack just the day before, namely, the Islamic Republic of Iran. The U.S. representative at the UN, Chris Liu, said things like, "Today was a powerful reminder that this is really about people's lives." He also said, "We send our sympathies to the Indian people, we stand in solidarity with them, and we are committed to ensuring that the perpetrators of this horrific attack are brought to justice." But no mention of Iran, especially since it lost 13 lives due to a terrorist attack, or the over 17,000 lives that it lost due to the MKO terrorist cult. Not that Iran was looking for sympathy from the U.S. After all, Iran's top intelligence bodies issued a joint statement just yesterday pointing to the major role of foreign intelligence agencies, especially the CIA, in orchestrating the violent riots in Iran in the past weeks. The announcement said, "Intelligence evidence shows that the CIA had devised an extensive plan with the cooperation of allied spy services and reactionary proxies before the start of the unrest to initiate a nationwide chaos with the aim of committing crimes against the great Iranian nation. In short, the intelligence ministries said the CIA played the main role while closely cooperating with the spy agencies of the UK, Israel, and Saudi Arabia. This should not come as a surprise, especially since the U.S. has executed color revolutions. In short, exporting wars, launching color revolutions, fomenting extremist ideologies, and promoting economic instability, especially through sanctions, are just some of the actions by the U.S. which has resulted in bloodshed and turmoil around the world. Some of those countries include Cuba, Ukraine, Syria, Iran, and Venezuela. Here is a man who has openly advocated for support for these rioters and who has said that the U.S. has been involved in U.S. regime change operations. Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton.
I disagree with that. As somebody who has helped plan coup d'etat, yeah, not here, but, you know, other places, it takes a lot of work. And that's not what he did. It was just stumbling around from one idea to another. Ultimately, he did unleash the rioters at the Capitol. As to that, there's no doubt.
But Iran has been one of the biggest victims of terrorism. Deputy Chief of Iran's Judiciary and head of the country's human rights headquarters, Kazem Gharibabadi, has blamed Western countries for their double standard policies on terrorism and described his nation as the biggest victim of terrorism. He said on the one hand, they accuse Iran of violating human rights, but on the other, they martyr 17,000 innocent Iranian citizens through terrorism or violate the rights of millions of Iranians through the imposition of unilateral sanctions and jeopardize their right to life. The U.S. administration and its allies are now looking to convene an informal private meeting of the U.N. Security Council on recent Iranian riots as an attempt to advance their political agenda. Imagine that, the ones committing instability in Iran to then discuss Iran's domestic affairs, among them the recent violent riots. The Iranian reaction has been swift. Iran's permanent mission to the U.N. said, given the hypocrisy and the use of double standards and selective practice of human rights, we regard American claims in support of Iranian women to be deceptive and lacking in good faith. He also stressed that based on reports by Iran's intelligence community, the U.S. itself was the main suspect behind the recent riots in Iran. And to make the situation even more hypocritical, according to a note outlining the events, it said it's the U.S. and Albania which will hold the informal U.N. Security Council gathering to happen on Wednesday. Of all countries, Albania, which has for years hosted anti-Iran terrorists in collusion with the U.S., the MKO, the same terrorist cult which the U.S. named as a terrorist entity once, but then took that label away. Albania does not only host this terrorist cult, but it has turned its country into a hub of interference by the terrorist group and countries hostile to Iran. It enjoys freedom of activity, even after being delisted by the European Union and the U.S. in 2009 and 2012, respectively, of the terrorist label. So it came as no surprise that the MKO terrorist cult was also actively involved in the recent riots in Iran. The findings of Iran's top intelligence body said that 49 MKO terrorists have been arrested. The terrorists were responsible for spreading fake news, instructing rioters to organize acts of terror and destruction, to direct slogans, and to be present on the streets to damage public property. This was in addition to the 77 members of anti-Iran terrorist groups that had also been arrested in the Iraqi Kurdistan region. 5 members of the Takfiri terrorist groups were also arrested in possession of 36 kilograms of explosives that were to be used to carry out bombings and gatherings. The ministry has further announced that 92 people affiliated with the former U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime had been arrested. It added that 9 nationals from Germany, Poland, Italy, France, the Netherlands, and Sweden were also arrested during the riots. Iranian intelligence ministry said a significant number of pistols, various types of machine guns and cartridges, as well as shotguns and ammunition were also seized. So it is quite hypocritical that the U.S. and its European allies impose sanctions on Iran for what they claim is a heavy-handed crackdown on violent protesters, and then move to convene a UN session on how to ratchet up further pressure on the Iranian government. Hypocritical also, since the U.S. and these European countries have all been doing the same to their own population, especially the U.S.
After the Friday prayers, people of Iran poured into the streets to express their disgust at the heinous act of terror by Daesh Takfiri terrorists and ask for revenge against the group. Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has already assured the nation that the perpetrators will face due punishment. President Ebrahim Raisi has also said that the root cause of the crime has been identified and that Iran will deliver a decisive blow to the architects and operatives of this plot, a blow that will make them regret ever committing such act. Daesh had already tried to pull off similar terrorist attacks in the country when they plotted the parliament attack and the bombing of Ayatollah Khomeini's mausoleum that left a dozen Iranians dead. Iran's anti-terror attacks ramped up significantly following the attacks on its soil through Iran's martyred anti-terror icon, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. While these were the only attacks on Iran claimed by Daesh, there have been several other terrorist attacks by other, more globally obscure but equally vicious groups. Among them, the Mujahideen Khalq organization, or the MKO, has the highest body count. 17,000 Iranians have died at the hands of the vile group that even joined forces with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war to carry out cross-border attacks. For years, the group was even on the U.S. list of terrorist groups before it was removed from the list in 2012 to receive funding more easily. Funding such as the massive annual events that the MKO manages to organize without having any backing by the people of Iran, neither inside the country nor outside. These events are often attended by top U.S. officials such as Donald Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, or a number of British members of parliament to at least attempt to give the so-called Free Iran Conventions the legitimacy it sorely lacks. Among other terrorist groups that, while definitely not on the scale of the previously mentioned two, have still tried to deprive Iran of its security, we can name Jundallah terrorist group led by Abdul Malik Righi. Righi's group was responsible for the death of tens of Iranians in the southeast province of Sistan and Baluchistan before he was arrested and executed by Iranian authorities. Separatist groups such as Al-Ahwaziyya and the Kurdish Komala have also been responsible for a few terrorist attacks in the west of Iran, with the latter serving a prominent role in the recent riots across the country. But their plot to capitalize on the riots to further their separatist agendas was quickly foiled by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The IRGC carried out two ballistic missile attacks on Komala's bases in Iraq's northern Kurdistan region. The IRGC had warned Iraq prior to the attack that Iran will not tolerate the existence of such groups who were, as reported by the IRGC, plotting to attack Western Iran in its neighborhood. According to a joint statement between Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and the intelligence organization of the IRGC, involvement of the U.S. in the recent riots in Iran has been proven. The U.S. and its spy agencies have even branched out their plans in three stages: before, during, and after the unrests. The CIA is referred to in the joint statement as the main culprit for inciting the riots. But the CIA is aided by Israel's Mossad and Saudi Foreign Intelligence Services, with the help of the most vicious of terrorist groups. Inciting despair among the Iranian population with the help of the massive amounts of funding that is given to foreign Farsi-speaking media outlets is listed among the primary tactics used to incite the unrests. Teaching effective escalation tactics during unrests have also been documented as another tactic used by these spy agencies. But among the many other items listed, none of them would be possible without the massive funding that the US, UK, Israel, and their Saudi allies give to the media outlets and individuals who capitalize on people's emotions. Also, supposedly international platforms such as Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter freely violate their own rules in this particular case and allow posts that incite violence to be freely uploaded onto their platforms. An extra $53 million have also been allocated by the CIA to give to these Farsi-speaking media outlets and individuals on top of their annual payments. Israeli influence, however, should not be ignored. Just recently, the IRGC dismantled a network of Mossad-affiliated terrorists in West Azerbaijan province. The investment of these spy agencies in inciting unrest in Iran has been proven time and time again, and cannot possibly fit into a short clip. Rest assured, you will hear about more evidence of foreign meddling in Iran's recent riots in the days and weeks to come.
Tehran has once again rejected baseless accusations about Iranian-made drones being used in the Ukraine war. The Islamic Republic's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, has clearly stated that Tehran would not remain indifferent if it is proven that Iranian drones are being used in the war in Ukraine against people. The top Iranian diplomat had previously stated that Tehran and Moscow have defensive cooperation, saying it's not Iran's policy to provide Russia with weapons and drones to be used in Ukraine. Tehran has time and again clearly stated its opposition to war and any escalation of conflict, urging self-restraint on both sides. Iranian officials say the allegations leveled against the country stem from an ongoing Western campaign to pressure the Islamic Republic. Russian officials have echoed similar remarks.
Everything that is now being done on the Iranian track is subordinated to one goal, pressure on this country. And Washington is mobilizing NATO and EU countries for this in support of its position.
Also, the US, EU, and UK have moved to impose sanctions on Iran over the baseless accusations, supporting the notion that the West only wants to put more pressure on Iran. Meanwhile, Britain, France, and Germany have called on the UN to investigate the allegation. But Iran's ambassador to the UN has described the possible probe as illegal within the framework of Resolution 2231. In a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antony Guterres, Amir Saeedi Ravani argued that the UN arms embargo on Iran mentioned in the resolution has expired in 2020, saying this means no Iranian sale or transfer of weapons or related materials to other countries is ever since subject to the resolution. The Iranian diplomat also urged the international body not to act based on the anti-Iran allegations by Western countries. Meanwhile, Russia had described the claims by the Western states as conspiracy theories, warning the UN against conducting a probe into such allegations.
No arms transfers in violation of Resolution 2231 have been ever conducted by Iran, and no drones were supplied by Iran to Russia for the use in the conflict in Ukraine.
Moscow has warned that it would reassess its cooperation with the world body if it carries out an investigation into the origins of the drones. Tehran has dismissed accusations by some Western countries and their media outlets that it provided weapons, including drones, to Russia for deployment against Ukraine. Iran's foreign ministry has called the allegations unfounded and made on the basis of misinformation and ill-intentioned presumptions. The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July, with U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleging that Washington had received information indicating that the Islamic Republic was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred drones, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline for use in the war in Ukraine. However, the Pentagon said it could not confirm the transfer of any Iranian weaponry to Russia. Since the very beginning, Iran rejected the claims, with the country's foreign ministry stating Tehran's preparedness to hold dialogue with Ukraine towards nullification of the allegations. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has even proposed a joint meeting between Iranian and Ukrainian military personnel and experts to review battlefield evidence of Iranian drones used by Russia in Ukraine. Despite that, Kyiv and its allies repeated the baseless American narrative without providing any evidence. The US, EU, and UK imposed sanctions against the country. So, if Kyiv and the West are so sure, then why are they reluctant to provide detailed evidence that supports their claims? Plus, while Iran has managed to advance its defensive capabilities despite US sanctions, is Washington using Ukraine as a false pretext to bring the Europeans along in a bid to impose an arms embargo against Iran to hamper the country's progress in the defense sector?
Iran has witnessed a deadly terrorist attack. The carnage happened at a holy shrine in the south-central city of Shiraz in Fars province. It left over a dozen people dead, including women and children. Over two dozen people were also injured in the attack. The bloodbath happened at the Shah Cheragh Shrine, which is one of the popular pilgrimage sites in Iran. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility. The gunman shot his way into the shrine through one of the entrances. He then headed to the main compound, where he opened fire at pilgrims and staff. Eyewitnesses have told reporters that loud screams were heard in the women's section of the shrine at prayer time, when suddenly an armed man was spotted with a Kalashnikov firing indiscriminately in the compound of the shrine. Officials say the perpetrator is a non-Iranian national who has been arrested. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei, has issued a statement on the incidents, saying that strong action must be taken to identify and tackle the root causes of such heinous crimes. The leader said that all people and entities in the country are responsible in the face of seditious acts by the enemy and their traitorous or ignorant stooges. He advised everyone to stay united against those undermining the people's security and disrespecting their sanctities. Iran says the attack is part of a larger plot to destabilize the country. Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian says that Tehran has reliable information that shows that terrorists and foreign meddlers have created a multi-layered scheme to make the country insecure. He says this latest attack has unraveled the sinister intentions of those promoting terror and violence in Iran. Earlier, President Ebrahim Raisi expressed his condolences to the families of the pilgrims who were killed or injured in the attack.
These riots paved the way for terrorist attacks. They came to Shah Cheragh Mausoleum and sprayed with bullets innocent people who were worshipping God. The ground for such terrorist attacks was prepared by riots.
The carnage in Iran has sparked a wave of condemnation. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has strongly censored the attack and called for bringing the perpetrators to justice. Syrian Foreign Ministry has called the mass shooting a cowardly act, while blaming the U.S. for using terror attacks as a tool to coerce nations into submission. Russia and China have also condemned the carnage. And Pakistan's Foreign Office spokesperson and the Speaker of the National Assembly have condemned the attack, saying the people of Pakistan share the grief of the Iranian nation. Sayyid Ammar al-Hakim, the head of Iraq's National Wisdom Coalition, also decried the attack. Iranian officials say the terrorist attack has revealed the actual extent of the enemy's cruelty. It comes against the backdrop of the latest foreign-backed riots, which erupted after a young woman, Mahsa Amini, died in the hospital 3 days after she collapsed in police custody. Iran has denounced the silence of human rights organizations on the terrorist crime in Shiraz. It says the terrorists based in the U.S. and Europe enjoy unwavering backing there, and Western countries refuse to publicly condemn terrorist incidents inside of Iran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardi.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي.
What non-Muslims say about Ali, the first successor of Prophet Muhammad. Wilfred Matalong, professor of Arabic at Oxford University, says the following about Imam Ali in his book, The Succession to Muhammad, A Study of the Early Caliphate, pages 309 to 310. In face of the fake Umayyad claim to legitimate sovereignty in Islam as God's vicegerents on earth, and in view of Umayyad treachery, arbitrary and divisive government, and vindictive retribution, they came to appreciate his honesty, his unbending devotion to the reign of Islam, his deep personal loyalties, his equal treatment of all his supporters, and his generosity in forgiving his defeated enemies.
Badar jaan girami fidaye naam Ali Badar jaan girami fidaye naam Ali Aidari.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, one of the beautiful things and intriguing things that we see in the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is the idea of social justice. Now, of course, we see that throughout the life of this divinely appointed Imam and this living miracle of the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, Imam Ali alayhi salam lived a life in which he was the embodiment of social justice. Now, when we see before Imam Ali reached to the Khalifate, the Khalifa of the Muslims, even during his life before this era, he emphasized and he worked on social justice. Of course, he always tried to help the poor. He tried to empower the downtrodden. And of course, he protected the oppressed. When it comes to social justice and being fair and equitable, especially in the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam, during the era of the Khilafah, when he was the caliph of the Muslims, we find that the way that he distributed the Baytul Mal, he distributed the funds of the public treasury, it was always in accordance to fairness and true justice. Now, unfortunately, the previous caliphs, the first three caliphs, and especially the third caliph, Usman, we find that the distribution of the Baytul Mal, the distribution of the public treasury, was done in an unjust manner. And this is something that is reflected in the history books, and it is a fact when we look into the history of the Muslims. And so when it came time to Imam Ali alayhi salam's caliphate, we find, of course, that His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam, he distributed this Baytul Mal in a just manner. Unlike the previous caliphs of the Muslims, the first three caliphs, who distributed the public treasury and the Baytul Mal based upon, for example, tribal alliances or friendships or different kinds of ulterior motives, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he actually distributed the Baytul Mal in an equitable and just manner. No longer was an Arab better than a non-Arab. No longer was a free person better than an enslaved person. And no longer was a man better than a woman, a friend better than an enemy, and so forth. It's actually quite interesting, but we see that even after the battle that Imam Ali had with the Khawarij, and the Khawarij opposed Imam Ali alayhi salam to an extent where they were killing the companions and even the women folk of the companions of Imam Ali alayhi salam, still the first divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, did not stop the public funding and the Baytul Mal from reaching the families of the Khawarij. In today's day and age, of course, social justice being something that is direly in need. We see a world almost completely filled up with social injustice. There is discrimination wherever we see. There is the discrimination between black and white, between local and foreigner, even between Arab and non-Arab, between English speaker and a non-English speaker, and so forth, between man and woman, of course. And in this day and age, truly, we can definitely benefit from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam when it comes to social justice, and to show us that all are equal before the eyes of Allah. The only difference is that he and she, or she who has more taqwa, more God consciousness, more piety, is more favorable and better in the eyes of Allah. A very beautiful and profound lesson regarding social justice brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. اللهم إن قلوب المخبتين إليك والها وسبل الراغبين إليك شارع
وعلى O Allah, verily the hearts of those who surrender to Thee are full of passionate love. The path of those who long for Thee is the straight, true road. The instructions given by those who lead on Thee are distinct and precise. The minds of those who are aware of Thy reality are filled with awe and reverence. The call of those who invite unto Thee is loud and clear.
and the doors of approval are kept open for them. Whoso submits his supplication to thee receives a favorable answer. Whoso turns repentant unto thee gets acceptance and amnesty. Whoso bursts into tears in fear of thy punishment obtains mercy. Whoso seeks redress from thee finds the required assistance at his disposal. Whoso asks for thy help procures the aid as a gift. Thy promise made with thy servants is fulfilled. Whoso asks for pardon of his errors finds them reduced to nothing. Whoso does everything for thy sake discovers that each and every deed has been preserved. The means of livelihood available to the created being come from thee like a rainfall, and in addition, many recurring favors and bounties reach them in regular succession. The sin of those who ask for forgiveness are overlooked. The wants and needs of all that which has been created by thee are properly satisfied. Those who put forward genuine demands get more than they ask for, one after the other, again and again. For the hungry, wholesome food is arranged. For the thirsty, clean water is available in abundance.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajabali.
Let me touch briefly the history. As you know, when Imam Ali alayhi salam, when they realized that they made mistakes, the people went to his house. After the third Khalifa was tragically killed, people ganged up on him and killed him. It's a tragic scenario when anyone is killed. I don't care who it is. And they go to the house of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they said, we acknowledge. They pulled him out of his house. They dragged him. Literally, they were so excited that you have to take that position that God has conferred upon you. For we have realized that the Muslim Ummah has degraded in so many ways. And you find Imam Ali alayhi salam accepts that with conditions. He said, you will obey me the way Allah has commanded, wa ulil amri minkum. They agreed. Sadly, when he comes into power, many forces had already taken their bases in deep formations. One being Muawiyah. Muawiyah, for 30 years plus, had been establishing himself and taking from the public treasury to build a vast empire. History a little bit, brothers and sisters. The Byzantine Empire, which is Syria today, that empire today, when it fell from the Christian hands to the Muslims, the first governor was Muawiyah's brother, who died very shortly before. And then right after that, as you know, Muawiyah takes governorship and never leaves it till his death. Never leaves that leadership. And remember, the people of Byzantium, who were Syrians of the time, had not seen Ahlul Bayt. It was foreign to them. They were Christians. And many had converted to Islam, either through trade or whatever means. But they were not aware of the true power of Ahlul Bayt. Thus, Muawiyah systematically kept them in the dark and created all kinds of false ideas against Ahlul Bayt, which culminates in Ashura, that after Imam Hussein alayhi salam is martyred, when Imam Zainul Abidin and Zainab alayhi salam enter the city of Sham, which is known as Syria, when they enter it, people were mocking at them. Mocking them that it's good God has killed you, or you recalcitrant people who are disobeying the caliph of the time. Not realizing that the ones that they killed were the blood and the prophet himself. Not realizing that. And that is why the power of the revolution of Karbala was so strong, that when Imam Zain al-Abidin enters the city of Sham and Imam Zain al-Abidin climbs the pulpit,